Part 2. Cards Up the Sleeve. Gamblers play just as lovers make love and drunkards drink. Blindly and of necessity, under domination of an irresistible force. Jacques-Anatole Thibault. Chapter 8. Summer's End. 1. Dark water across the bow. Water at the sides, water in the air, falling with the weight of lead pellets against Locke's oilcloak. The rain seemed to come first from one side and then another, never content to fall straight down, as the red messenger rocked back and forth in the grey hands of the gale. "Master Valora!" Locke held fast to the safety lines knotted around the mainmast, as they were knotted all around the deck, and bellowed down the main deck hatch. "How much water in the well?" Jean's answer came up a few moments later. 2 feet! "Very good, Master Valora." Locke caught a glimpse of bald Mazuka staring at him, and he suppressed a feeling of unease. He knew that Caldris' sudden death the day before had been taken by the crew as an omen of the worst sort. They were openly muttering about women and cats, and the focal point of all their unkind attention was one Orin Ravel, whose status as captain and saviour was steadily fraying. Locke turned toward the helmsman and found him once again squinting ahead into the stinging rain, seemingly absorbed in his duty. 2 cloaked sailors stood at the second wheel behind Mazuka. In seas this strong, control of the rudder could easily fly free from the grip of a single man. Their faces were dark shadows within their hoods. They had nothing friendly to say to Locke, either. The wind screamed through the lines and yards overhead, where most of the sails were tightly furled. They continued to push vaguely southwest under the press of nothing but close-reefed topsails. They were heeled over so far to starboard that Mazuka and his assistants were not merely standing in wait at their wheels. The crashing sea demanded their constant, tedious concentration to keep the ship stable, and still the sea was rising. A rush of grey-green water ran over Locke's bare toes, and he sucked in breath. He'd abandoned his boots for the more certain footing of unprotected feet. Locke watched that water roll across the deck, unwelcome but constant guest, before it poured away down the scuppers and leaked past the edges of the storm canvas laid beneath the hatch gratings. In truth, the water was warm, but here in the sunless heart of the storm, with the wind like knives in the air, his imagination made it seem cold. "Captain Ravel!" Jabril was approaching along the larboard rail, storm lantern in one night-black hand. "It might have been advisable to take down the fucking topgallant masts a few hours ago," he shouted. Since Locke had risen that morning, Jabril had offered at least half a dozen rebukes and reminders without prompting. Locke stared upward at the very tips of the main and foremasts, nearly lost in the swirling haze overhead. "I gave it some thought, Jabril, but it didn't seem necessary." According to some of what Locke had read, even without sails flying from their yards, the topgallant masts might give unwanted leverage to deadly storm winds, or even be lost over the side as the vessel bucked and heaved. He'd been too busy to think of striking them down. "It'll seem pretty God's damned necessary if they come down and take more of the rigging with them. I might have them struck down in a while, Jabril, if I think it proper." "If you think it proper?" Jabril gaped at him. "Are you bereft of your bloody senses, Ravel? The time to strike the bastards was hours ago. Now the hands we have are in sore need elsewhere, and the fucking weather's up. We might try it only were the ship in peril. But damn me, she might soon be. Have you not been out this far on the Sea of Brass before, Captain?" "Aye, of course I have." Locke sweated within his oil cloak. Had he known the real extent of Jabril's sea wisdom, he might have tasked the man with minding such details, but now it was too late, and some of his incompetence was laid bare. "Forgive me, Jabril. Caldris was a good friend. His loss has left me a bit off kilter." "Indeed! As the loss of the fucking ship might leave us all more than a touch off kilter, sir." Jabril turned and began making his way forward along the larboard rail, then after a few seconds whirled back to Locke. "You and I both know for a damn truth there's not a single bloody cat on board, Ravel!" Locke hung his head and clung to the mizzen. It was too much to hope that Mazooka and the hands standing behind him hadn't heard that. But of course, at his glance, they said nothing and betrayed nothing, staring fixedly ahead into the storm as though trying to imagine he were not there at all. 2. Below decks was a nightmare. At least on deck one had masts and crashing seas to offer some perspective on one's place. Down here, in the enveloping fog of sweat, urine, and vomit, the shuddering walls themselves seemed to tilt and lurch at malicious whim. Streams of water poured down from hatchways and gratings, despite the weather precautions the crew had taken. The main deck echoed with the muffled howling of the wind, and the clanking sound of the pumps rose from the orlop below. Those pumps were fine Ferrari gearwork, capable of heaving water up and dashing it over the side at some speed, but they demanded 8-man shifts in seas like this, and the labor was backbreaking. Even a crew in good health would have found the job onerous. It was just plain bad luck for this bunch that so few of them had come out of prison at anything near their full strength. "The water gains, Captain," said a sailor Locke couldn't recognize in the near darkness. He'd popped his head up the hatchway from the orlop. 3 feet in the well. Aspel says we busted a seam somewhere. Says he needs men for a repair party." Aspel was their approximation of a ship's carpenter. "He'll have them," Locke said, though from where he knew not. 10 doing important work on deck, 8 at the pumps. Damn near their time to be relieved, too. 6 or 7 still too bloody weak to be of any use save as ballast. A squad in the orlop holed with Jean, resecuring casks of food and water after 3 had come loose and broken open. 8 sleeping fitfully on the main deck, just a few feet away, having been up all night. 2 with broken bones, trying to dull the pain with an unauthorized ration of wine. Their rudimentary scheme of watches was unraveling in the face of the storm's demands, and Locke struggled to subsume a sharp pang of panic. "Fetch Master Valora from the orlop," he said at last. "Tell him he and his men can look to the stores again once they've given Aspel a hand."
"Aye, sir."
"Captain Ravel!" Another shout rose from below as the first sailor disappeared, and Locke stood over the hatchway to answer. "What passes?" "Our time at the bloody pump, sir. We can't keep up this god's damn peace forever. We need relief, and we need food." "You shall have them both," said Locke, "in but 10 minutes. Though from where, again, he knew not. All his choices were sick, injured, exhausted, or otherwise engaged. He turned to make his way back up to the deck. He could swap the deck watch and the men at the pumps. It would bring joy to neither group, but it might serve to nudge the ship ahead of total disaster for a few more precious hours. 3. "What do you mean you haven't been turning the glasses?"
"Captain Ravel, sir, begging your double fucking pardon, but we ain't had no time to turn the glasses nor mind the log since, hell, I suppose I can't say, a while now."
Bald Mazooka and his mate looked more like they were clinging to his wheel for dear life than steering the ship with it. 2 teams of 2 had the wheels. The air was a frenzy of howling wind and stinging rain. The sea, cresting 20 feet or more, slammed past the bow again and again, washing the deck white and sluicing past Locke's ankles. At long last, they'd been forced to abandon a southerly course, and now they were dead west before the wind, pulled by one lonely storm forecourse. They scudded again and again through waves high as houses. A bolt of yellow flitting past in the periphery of Locke's vision was a storm lantern flying free and vanishing over the side, soon to be a curiosity for the fish far below. Locke hauled himself over to the binnacle and flipped through the damp pages of the master's log. The last hasty entry read, 3rd hour afternoon, 7 festal, 78 morgante, south-southwest, 8 knots, please may Yono spare these souls. Locke couldn't remember when it had last felt like the 3rd hour of the afternoon. The storm turned high noon, dark as the insides of a shark's gullet, and the crackle of lightning gave uncanny illumination to what might have been deep evening. They were as unfixed in time as they were in place.
"At least we know we're somewhere on the Sea of Brass," he shouted above the din. "We'll be through this mess soon enough, and then we'll take sightings to fix our latitude."
If only that was as easily done as said. Fear and exhaustion had set Locke's senses reeling. The world was grey and whirling in every direction, and he'd thrown up his last cold meal at the taffrail, gods knew when, hours before, probably. If Bondsmage of Carthane had appeared on deck at that moment and offered to use magic to steer the ship to safety, Locke might have kissed their boots. There was a sudden terrible sound overhead, an explosive crack followed by the warbling hiss of a broken line lashing the air. Seconds later came a louder crash, and then a snap, 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 like the noise of a whip biting flesh.
"Where above?"
cried Jabril from somewhere forward, and Locke and the ship seemed to lurch at once from another hammering wave. It was this loss of footing that saved Locke's life. A shadow swooped past his left shoulder as he slipped to the wet deck, sputtering. There was a splintering crash, screams, and sudden blackness as something slick and yielding enshrouded him. Sail canvas. Locke shoved at it, working his way out from beneath it. Strong hands grabbed his forearms and hauled him to his feet. They belonged to Jean, who was braced against the starboard quarterdeck rail. Locke had slid a few feet to his right with the fall. Muttering thanks, he turned to see exactly what he feared. The main topgallant mast had torn away. Its stays must have been snapped by some trick of wind or the ship's tumult. It had plunged forward and down, unfurling and trailing sail from its yard as it went, before a mess of tangled rigging had snapped it backward like a pendulum just above the deck. It covered the wheels, and the four men previously manning them were nowhere to be seen. Locke and Jean moved in unison, fighting across wet canvas and torn rope, while smaller pieces of debris continued to rain down around them. Already Locke could feel the ship moving in an unhealthy fashion beneath them. The wheels must be seized, the rudder put right instantly.
"All hands!" Locke cried with every ounce of conviction he possessed. "All hands on deck! All hands to save the ship!"
Jean heaved against the fallen topgallant spar, bracing himself against the mainmast, letting loose a howl of sheer exertion. Wood and canvas shifted, then crashed to the deck. Some of the handles of the two wheels had been reduced to splinters, but the wheels themselves were substantially intact. Locke could now see Bald Mazooka crawling slowly to his feet behind them. Another man lay on deck with the top of his head plainly smashed in.
"Seize the wheel!" Locke cried, looking around for more help. "Seize the bloody wheel!"
He found himself tangled with Jabril.
"Captain!" Jabril hollered straight into his face. "We are like to broach!"
"Oh, good," thought Locke. "At least I know what that means." He gave Jabril a shove toward the wheels and grabbed onto one beside Jean.
"Helm a larboard!"
Locke coughed, confident of that much. Groaning with strain, he and Jean fought to heave the wheel in the proper direction. The Red Messenger was slipping to lee at an angle, down into the troughs of the waves. In moments she'd be broadside to them and all but lost. A dark wave, impossibly heavy, surged over the starboard rail and doused them all, the merest foretaste of what awaited failure. But the resistance of the wheel lessened as Jabril found his place behind them and heaved. In seconds he was joined by Mazooka, and inch by straining inch Locke felt the ship's stern come round again to larboard, until her bow was knifing into the waves once more. They'd bought time to contemplate the disaster the toppling mast had made of the rigging. Men boiled out of the deck hatches, inhuman shapes in the dancing light of storm lanterns. Lightning scorched the darkness above them. Orders were issued from Locke and Jean and Jabril, with no heed paid to whose was the higher authority. The minutes became hours, and the hours felt like days. They fought on together in an eternity of grey chaos, cold and exhausted and terrified, against the screaming winds above and the hammering waters below. 4.
3 feet of water in the well and holding, Captain.
Aspel delivered his report with a makeshift bandage wrapped around his head, the sleeve of someone's jacket roughly slashed from its parent garment.
Very good, said Locke,
holding himself up at the mainmast much as Caldris had days before. Every joint and muscle in Locke's body announced their discomfort. He felt like a rag doll full of broken glass, and he was soaked in the bargain. But in that he was no different from any of the survivors aboard the Red Messenger. As Chains had once said, feeling like you wanted desperately to die was fine evidence that you had yet to do so. The Summer's End storm was a receding line of darkness on the northwestern horizon. It had spit them out a few hours earlier. Here the seas were running at 5 or 6 feet, and the skies were still ashen grey, but this was a paradise following the tempest. Enough funereal light filtered down from above for Locke to guess that it was day, after some fashion. He surveyed the shambles of the deck. Lifelines and debris from the rigging were tangled everywhere. Scraps of canvas fluttered in the wind, and sailors were tripping over fallen block and tackle, cursing as they went. They were a crew of ghosts, haggard and clumsy with fatigue. Jean labored at the forecastle to conjure their first warm meal in living memory.
Damnation!
Locke muttered. Their escape had not been without price. 3 swept clean overboard, 4 seriously injured, 2 dead, including Caldris. Merlon, the cook, had been the man at the wheel when the main topgallant mast had crashed down upon him like a divine spear and shattered his skull.
No, Captain, said Jabril from behind him. Not if we can do right by them.
What? Locke whirled confused. Suddenly he remembered. Oh, yes, of course.
The Fallen, Captain, said Jabril, enunciating as though to a child. The Fallen haunt our decks and cannot rest until we send them off proper.
Aye, said Locke. Let's do that. Caldris and Merlon lay by the larboard entry port, wrapped in canvas. Pale packages bound with tarred rope awaiting their final send-off. Locke and Jabril knelt beside them.
"See the words, Ravel," muttered Jabril. "You can do that much for them. Send their souls on down to Father Stormbringer and give them rests."
Locke stared at the 2 wrapped corpses and felt a new pain in his heart. Nearly overcome with fatigue and shame, he put his head in his hands and thought quickly. By tradition, ship's captains could be proclaimed lay priests of Yono, with a minimum of study at any proper temple to the Father of Grasping Waters. At sea, they could then lead prayers, perform marriages, and even give death blessings. While Locke knew some interior ritual of Yono's temple, he wasn't consecrated in Yono's service. He was a priest of the Crooked Warden. And here at sea, 1,000 miles out into Yono's domain, aboard a ship that was already damned for spurning his mandates, there was no way in heavens or hells Locke could presume to give these men Yono's rest. For the sake of their souls, he'd have to invoke the only power he had any pull with.
Crooked Warden, unnamed 13th, your servant calls. Place your eyes upon the passing of this man, Caldris Balcomar, Yono's servant, sworn to steal goods beneath the red flag, therefore sharing a corner of your kingdom.
What are you doing?
Jabril hissed, seizing Locke by the arm. Locke shoved him backward.
The only thing I can do, said Locke, the only honest blessing I can give these men, understand? Don't fucking interfere again.
He reached back down to touch Caldris' wrapped body.
We deliver this man, body and spirit, to the realm of your brother Yono, mighty lord of the sea.
Locke figured a little flattery never went amiss in these matters.
Lend him aid, carry his soul to she who weighs us all. This we pray with hopeful hearts.
Locke gestured for Jabril's help. The muscular man remained deadly silent as they lifted Caldris' body together and heaved it out the entry port. Even before he heard the splash, Locke reached back down to the other canvas bundle.
Crooked Warden, Thief Watcher, your servant calls.
Place your eyes upon the passing of this man, Merlon, Yono's servant, sworn to steal goods beneath a red flag, therefore sharing a corner of your kingdom. 5. The mutiny came the next morning, while Locke slept senseless in his hammock, still wearing the wet clothes that had seen him through the storm. He was awakened by the sound of someone slamming his door and shooting home the bolt. Bleary-eyed and gasping in confusion, he all but fell out of his hammock and had to use his sea chest to push himself unsteadily to his feet.
"Arm yourself," said Jean,
backing away from the door with both of his hatchets in hand.
"We've got a problem."
That brought Locke to full wakefulness sharply enough. He buckled on his sword belt in haste, noting with satisfaction that the heavy shutters over his stern windows were still drawn. Light peeked in around the edges. Was it day already? Gods, he'd slept the whole night away in one dreamless blink.
"There's some of them that aren't happy with me, aren't there?"
"None of them are happy with us."
"I think they're surely angrier with me than they are with you. I think you could still make it as one of them. It's my blood they'll be after, and you can claim to be as much my dupe as they were. Take me out to them. You might still pull this scheme off and get the antidote from Strugos."
"Are you mad?"
Jean glared back at Locke, but didn't step away from the door.
"You're a strange fellow, brother." Locke contemplated his Ferrari Sea Officer's saber uneasily. In his hands, it would be no less a showpiece than it was now in its scabbard.
"First you want to punish yourself for something that's not your fault, and now you won't let me slip you out of a mistake that's entirely mine."
"Who the hell are you to lecture me, Locke? First you insist that I stay despite the real danger I pose to you. Now you beg me to betray you for gain? Fuck you! You're 10 pints of crazy in a 1-pint glass."
"That describes us both, Jean." Locke smiled despite himself. There was something refreshing in being returned to danger of his own making after the indifferent malice of the storm.
"Though you're more of a carafe than a pint glass. I knew you wouldn't buy it."
"Too goddamned right."
"I will say, I would have liked to see Strugos' face when we did whatever we were going to do to him," said Locke. "And I would have liked to know what it was when the clever moment came."
"Well," said Jean, "as long as we're wishing, I would have liked 1,000,000 solari and a parrot that speaks Throne Therin, but they're not coming, take my meaning."
"Maybe the fact that this scuppers Strugos' precious little plan is fuck you enough."
"Now, Locke," Jean sighed, and his voice softened, "maybe they'll want to talk first. And if they want to talk to you, with your wits about you, we might still have a chance.
Doubtless you're the only man aboard this ship who'd still express confidence in anything I do."
Locke sighed.
"Ravel!"
The shout came from the companionway.
"You didn't kill any of them yet, did you, Jean?"
"Not yet, no." "Ravel! I know you're in there, and I know you can hear me!"
Locke stepped up to the cabin door and shouted back through it.
"Marvelously clever, Jibril! You've tracked me unerringly to the cabin in which I've been fast asleep and motionless all bloody night. Who tipped you off?"
"We have all the bows, Ravel."
"Well, damn," said Locke. "You must have gotten into the weapon lockers, then. I suppose I was hoping we could have one of those pleasant dancing mutinies, or maybe a singing and card games mutiny, you know?"
"There's 32 of us can still move, Ravel. 2 of you in there, no food, no water. The ship's ours. How long do you figure on staying in there?"
"It's a fine place," shouted Locke. "Got a hammock, a table, nice view out the stern, big door between us and the rest of you."
"Which we can smash at any time, and you know it."
Jibril lowered his voice. A creak of shifting weight in the companionway told Locke he'd stepped right up to the other side of the door.
"You're glib, Ravel. But glib's no good against 10 bows and 20 blades."
I'm not the only man in here, Jibril.
Aye, and believe me, there's not one among us who'd like to face Master Valora. Not with fucking 4-1 odds. But the odds is better than that. Like I said, we got all the bows. You want it to come down hard, we'll do what it takes.
Locke bit the inside of his cheek, thinking.
You swore an oath to me, Jibril. An oath to me as your captain, after I gave you your lives back.
We all did, and we meant it, but you're not what you said you was. You're no sea officer. Caldris was the real thing, gods rest him, but I don't know what the fuck you are. You deceived us, so the oath don't stand.
I see.
Locke pondered, snapped his fingers, and continued.
So you would have kept to the oath had I, been what I claimed to be?
Aye, Ravel. Fucking right we would have.
I believe you, said Locke. I believe you're no oath-breaker, Jibril. So I have a proposal. Jerome and I are willing to come peaceably out of the cabin. We'll come up on the deck and we'll talk. We'll be pleased to hear your grievances, every last one. And we'll keep our hands empty, so long as you swear an oath to give us that much. Safe conduct to the deck and an open talk for everyone.
Won't be no hearing grievances, Ravel. It'll just be us telling you how it's to be.
As you wish, said Locke. Call it whatever you like. Give me your oath of safe passage and it'll happen. We'll come out right now.
Locke strained for several seconds to hear anything from the companionway. At last, Jibril spoke.
"Come up with empty hands," he said, "and don't make no unkind moves, especially not Valora. Do that, and I swear before all the gods you'll come up to the deck safe. Then we'll talk."
"Well," whispered Jean, "at least you got us that much."
"Yeah. Maybe just the chance to die in the sunlight rather than the shade, though."
He considered changing out of his wet clothes before going up on deck, then shook his head.
"Hell with it! Jibril?"
"Aye?"
"We're opening the door."